Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
To what extent were a corrupt club owner and a manager who was partnering with the most notorious gambler in New York responsible for what happened in the World Series 97 years ago? As we anticipate the next game in what may soon have to be called the Early Winter Classic, you can find explorations of these questions and lots of good baseball talk as well in the first Fall Classic, subtitled The Red Sox, the Giants, and the cast of players, pugs, and politicos who reinvented the World Series in 1912. New York Post sports writer Mike Vaccaro is the author of that book, and when I had the opportunity to speak with him earlier this week, I began our conversation by asking him to talk just a little about what made that 1912 World Series especially deserving of our attention.
Number of things, Bill. I mean, the number of characters on the field, both for their on-field ability and also for their off-field colorfulness, was substantial. You had five Hall of Famers, including a Hall of Fame manager, probably one of the best managers of all time in John McGraw. You even had two Hall of Fame umpires. So on the field, the product was terrific. It went to the ultimate game, went to eight games because there was a tie, and extra innings of game eight. So that alone would make it a classic. But there was so much other intrigue involved. I mean, you got to remember this was 7 years before the 1919 World Series, and there was a substantial gambling presence. You knew any ballpark you went to, you knew where you could find a bookmaker or anybody else who would want to take a bet for you. And that played a substantial a part in the series, as did the idea that, players, we tend to think the players of that part of the century were playing for the love of the game, when in fact they probably played for money harder than the players today do. And there was a lot of hard feelings throughout the series on both ends. So that made for real fascinating games, both on and off the field.
No, in fact, just to take up one of your points, Christy Mathewson, who has been celebrated for many years as I say, a paragon off the field, the Christian gentleman among baseball players, and he said, hey, we're playing for money. That's how we feed our families.
And not only that, but, there was an issue for the players. Because of the tie, they wanted for the first five games to count toward the player pool because one of those games wasn't resolved. And from the beginning of the World Series and leading on to today, players are only paid for the first four games of the series as an attempt to discourage them from trying to artificially extend the series. But because there had been a tie, the players believe they were entitled to an extra game, and the guy that they sent to represent them to the National Commission was Christy Mathewson. And he spoke longly and eloquently, and afterward in his newspaper column had no problem taking on baseball, saying this was a bad thing, saying it was terrible. And, it's true. The one thing that was consistent with all these guys, and almost all of them wrote newspaper columns during the World Series, certainly were available to give their opinions during the World Series, they wouldn't say, we're playing for the ring or we're playing for the pennant, we're playing for the flag. They'd say, we're playing for the winner's share. and they were unapologetic about it. And, at a time when most ballplayers are making about $3,000 a year, this is an opportunity for them to almost double their salary.
Lots of people revere Boston's Fenway Park, which was, of course, new in 1912 when this series was played. But you described the Polo Grounds where the New York Giants played as a, quote, a basilica. What earned that ballpark such praise?
It was so ornate. And it's funny, when Yankee Stadium would open about 11 years later, it was very obvious where the inspiration for a lot of its more elegant touches were. I mean, when the Polo Grounds, this version of the Polo Grounds, which was the final version of the Polo Grounds, when it opened up midway through the 1911 season, it was the biggest ballpark in the country. It was the largest outfield because it was shaped like a horseshoe. So, I mean, the center field seemed to go on forever. And the way it was designed, we tend to write almost poetry about the facade, the copper frieze at Yankee Stadium, but they had an even more elaborate design ringing the top of the Polo Grounds, and they had about 100 eagles standing guard, so, and gargoyles and all this kind of stuff. It was like walking into a Roman Colosseum as much as it was to a baseball park.
Of course, Mike, those of us who grew up in the 50s in the New York area know that that ballpark was designed with that gigantic center field just in case Willie Mays might one day come along to play it.
That's exactly right. And I think that's one of the nice things about this particular World Series is that actually one of the guys who roamed center field played for the Red Sox, Tris Speaker, who's considered one of the two or three best defensive center fielders of all time. And so he was able to kind of break it in a little bit for Willie a couple of decades early.
Certainly part of the distinction of the 1912 series was that the teams were evenly matched. As you say, it took them 8 games to decide a winner. But beyond that, the players on those two teams didn't much like each other. Why was that?
Well, I think it starts, Bill, with this proximity. I mean, the civic dislike. Boston and New York were always rivals as cities, going back to the Revolutionary War when Boston was a hotbed of revolutionary activity, and much of New York was loyal to the crown, and it kind of stayed that way for various other reasons, the rivalry between Boston Harbor and New York Harbor. So, and don't forget 1904. You know, you talked about the interruption earlier in the World Series. 1904, the Giants refused to play the American League champion. That so happened to be the Red Sox. So there was still a lot of hard feelings about the Giants not allowing the Red Sox to defend that first World Series championship. And then once they played each other, the intensity of the games was off the charts. McGraw was known from his days in Baltimore to do anything he could and would teach anything he could to his players to gain an advantage. And during the tie game, the tying run actually scored when Tris Speaker hit what in essence was an inside-the-park home run, and he was slowed down in his path to tying the game by the Giants' third baseman, Buck Herzog, who he didn't necessarily grab his belt loop, but he didn't necessarily not grab his belt loop either. And when Speaker crossed the plate, the first thing, he didn't go for the third baseman. He went for McGraw because he knew who taught him all this. Mm-hmm. And this was the kind of stuff that would go on throughout the course of the series. Spikes high, people not really worrying about getting their uniform dirty. And, you know, obviously, you know, both teams wanted what the other team wanted, which was to win this championship, but as we said earlier, to win the winner's share of the money, which was important to everybody.
Weather played a role in the 1912 World Series. Both fields were often wet, and darkness played a role as well. In fact, because they couldn't see the field very well at one particular game, the fans left thinking that the team that lost had won. Tell us about that.
Absolutely right. That was game 3. Game 2 had been called because of darkness, because, you know, these games started around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which was, you know, when you think about it, we know what October daylight is like. So they were kind of playing with fire anyway, and because the game lasted longer than it normally would last, it wound up ending in a tie. In game 3, the Giants were holding on to a very precarious one-run lead, and the ball was hit into the outfield. And Josh DeVore, the Giants outfielder, made a running catch in the gloaming and didn't bother to come back to the dugout. He just kept running to the clubhouse. And afterward, you know, it sounds you know, fanciful, but this was in just about every newspaper account. A lot of the Red Sox fans who were late for supper and wanting to get home before it got dark, once they saw the ball go toward the gap, they left. They left thinking, well, this is the ball game. And in fact, there's a funny story that Fred Lieb, the great old New York sports writer, tells about being in a hotel lobby later on, and there was this drunk Red Sox fan who was celebrating about the fact that the Red Sox were now up 2-0, and Lieb had to break it to him that it was actually the Giants who won the game, and the guy wanted to fight him. And so he said, and so they actually made a wager and said, I'll find you an early edition of the newspaper. And they did. And there it was in black and white. And, you know, in those wonderful days, people really did rely almost exclusively on newspapers for their information. And the guy had to admit, oh, I guess I didn't see what I thought I saw.
The Red Sox seemed to be on the brink of winning the 1912 series in Game 6, which everyone thought would find Smokey Joe Wood on the mound. And then the team's owner, James McAleer, told his manager, Jake Stahl, to sit Wood down, to not pitch him that day. Was McAleer trying to extend the series to make more money? And if so, didn't that constitute a fix just as crooked as what would happen 7 years later with the Black Sox?
Absolutely, Bill, and that's the irony. Is, you know, we talked earlier about how the owners had conspired, where the players would only get paid for the first 4 games because they didn't want the players to artificially extend the series, but there was no safeguard for the owners doing the same trick, which is essentially what happened here. I mean, not only did McAleer know that by holding Wood back a game, they'd have a lot better chance of clinching the game, and actually in Game 7. Back at Fenway Park, he also knew that the guy that he was going to suggest pitch, Buck O'Brien, had already begun to enjoy the train ride back to New York and was planning on enjoying a full night in New York. So he realized he wasn't going to be having a 100% pitcher pitching for himself the next day either. It didn't bother him. And that's actually what caused, you know, this World Series to really become on a different level in a lot of ways, Bill, because Smokey Joe Wood was very upset that he wasn't pitching that day. And beyond that, His brother, a lot of his brother's friends, a lot of family members had gone to the Polo Grounds with the idea of, you know, wagering a substantial sum on the Red Sox, knowing that as sure a thing as there ever was Joe Wood pitching in 1912. And he didn't pitch, and they lost the game, and a lot of people lost a lot of money, and Joe Wood was very angry. And that brings us to Game 7 in Fenway Park the next day, where, you know, Joe Wood never copped to this. But all we know for fact is that he pitched a total of 13 pitches that day, surrendered 6 runs, and didn't seem terribly upset by it. In fact, one of the runs was helped along by the fact that with runners on first and second early in the inning, he eschewed the stretch position and went to the windup, which, you know, 7-year-old pitchers in their backyard know that you go to the stretch position when you have a runner on first and second. And so, you know, again, this wasn't anything that was admitted to ever. And Joe Wood lived a very long life. But people who saw know what they saw. And in fact, the Red Sox fans, who were no dummies, when they saw their team lose that day, they stayed away in droves for Game 8. I mean, Game 8 was one of the greatest games probably of all time, certainly one of the best games ever played in the World Series, and Fenway Park was half empty, even though, you know, for years to come, there were probably 400,000 people who told you they were there. But really, in actuality, there were only about 14 or 15,000 who were there.
We've spoken a good deal about gambling, and it probably won't surprise our listeners to know that gambling was a fairly large component of baseball games around 1912. But they may be surprised that the Giants' manager, John McGraw, was an active partner with a fellow named Arnold Rothstein, the gambler who eventually financed the fixing of the World Series in 1919.
I'll tell you what, Bill, of all the things that I learned that I didn't know before, and I thought that I won't say I was any kind of expert of ragtime baseball or John McGraw's era baseball, but I certainly, you know, I certainly knew about the Black Sox. I knew about that, about the, you know, the intrigue that surrounded games in that era. It stunned me when I discovered, you know, that John McGraw and Arnold Rothstein were actually business partners. Now, McGraw was a guy who loved baseball, and he would give his last hour on earth to manage a baseball game if he could. But he also didn't mind making a buck. You know, him and his coach, Wilbert Robertson, opened up the first duck pin bowling lanes in the East Coast and made a fortune in that when they were in Baltimore together. So he had an eye and an ear for business, and Arnold Rothstein was a prominent New Yorker, as was John McGraw. Obviously, they ran in different circles, or similar circles, depending on how you look at it. and they opened up pool halls together all around New York in between 1910 1917, around there. And, you know, it kind of goes without saying that the games contained in those walls probably weren't reserved just for nine ball. You know, when you're talking about Arnold Rothstein, who was a prominent underworld figure in New York at the time, and as you said, went on to lasting fame as the guy who kind of masterminded the 1919 World Series. And what's funny, or just very interesting to me, is that, you know, John McGraw is never really mentioned ever in any of the stories you read about the 1919 Black Sox. Obviously, it was the other league and so forth, but it does make you wonder. I mean, obviously, if John McGraw and Arnold Rothstein had this relationship, certainly they talked, you would think, once in a while. So it certainly leads to a lot of other possibilities that, you know, I guess, you know, are certainly left unsaid in the book, but you don't have to keep them left unsaid if you want to talk about it in a saloon sometime.
Perhaps the saddest story to come out of the 1912 series was New York outfielder Fred Snodgrass's muff of a fly ball. 60-odd years later, it was the beginning of his obituary, and it was an error that some felt cost the Giants the World Series. But Snodgrass didn't let being called the goat of the series get him down, did he?
He really didn't, and I think it's very interesting. Snodgrass was the center fielder on the Giants in the 10th inning of the 1912 World Series, easy fly ball, and he would forever say it was the easiest fly ball he ever had to handle, and he dropped it. He flat dropped it, and it started the wheels in motion for what became a winning Red Sox rally. Snodgrass went on to become a politician, a businessman, very rich, lived a very happy, full life, and died in his 80s.
Of course, the irony of the Fred Snodgrass situation is he also made what some people felt was the greatest catch in World Series history in the same series, same game.
The very next batter, in fact, and the rest of Harry Hooper was the guy who hit the ball, and the rest of his life, you know, Hooper couldn't stop talking about this one hit he was robbed of, you know, when he was 25 years old, and that's how incredible the catch was. But obviously, if the Giants would have prevailed in that inning, maybe the catch would have been better known than the muff. But the muff is the thing that people always remember Fred Snodgrass for.
Mike Vaccaro is a sports columnist for the New York Post, and he's the author of the first fall classic, The Red Sox, the Giants, and the cast of players, Pugs and Politicos, who reinvented the World Series in 1912. The book is published by Doubleday, and Mike Vaccaro joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mike, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Great talking to you, Bill. Thanks so much for having me on today.
My conversation with Mike Vaccaro, the author of the first fall classic, will be featured in this week's program. I'll also be talking with ESPN's Tim Kirkjian just to see if what Phillies pitcher Cliff Lee did to the Yankees on Wednesday night has shaken Tim's conviction that the Yankees will win the current fall classic. We'll have a story about a football team that was a laughing stock not so long ago, and then for a while it was a giggling stock and briefly a smirking stock, and now the Cincinnati Bengals appear to be playoff bound again. So we'll hear something about them. Only a Game's Doug Trabue, who recently visited Tiffany & Company, will tell us how the sports world's shiniest and most costly trophies are constructed, polished, and tested for durability. You ever wonder how they get all those little dimples into the silver basketballs on those trophies? Because Doug got the story. And Only a Game's Karen Given will report from perhaps the most prestigious oyster-shucking competition west of the Atlantic Ocean, and not very far west at that. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.